Rest. I think Sunday mornings for a lot of us are anything but restful. As we kind of gather our gaggle of children and herd them like cats into the vehicle and then maybe feed them at a trough kind of idea. Get them cereal. But rest is not something that is oftentimes part of our morning routine on Sundays. Today's passage actually is all about rest. Ruth 3. In Ruth 3, we find that the main idea is this. God is preparing a place of rest through the Redeemer's work. God is preparing a place of rest through the Redeemer's work. And the exhortation for our hearts today is this: rest in the Redeemer's work as we wait for his return. Ruth chapter 3. Last week we were introduced to our knight in shining armor, Boaz, whose introduction immediately points us to Emmanuel with his first words, "The Lord be with you." We watched as God providentially worked in the just so happened instances of Ruth 2. And he did that to display his steadfast love to a lowly servant Moabite widow and her mother-in-law. The big punchline at the end of chapter 2 was that Boaz wasn't just a friend of Elimelech. He was a goel, a kinsman redeemer, one who is designed by God to provide, protect, and propagate the family line of Elimelech in the shadow of Elimelech's death. So if you think about the structure of Ruth, my mind is on Luke as well because that's where we're headed in the future. But Ruth, if you think about the structure, it's kind of laid out in acts like a drama. So act one is most of chapter one. Act two is chapter two. Act three is right here. So like act two, though, the structure is very similar. In chapter two, well, like acts two in chapter two, act three begins and ends with a conversation between Ruth and Boaz. And right in the middle is the cream filling of an introduction an interaction with Boaz. That's the structure of Ruth 2 and Ruth 3. And that's the framework for how we're going to view this chapter. Scene 1, I didn't put it in PowerPoint today, I'm sorry. I'll explain it and I'll say it a couple different times in case you want to write it down. Scene 1 is this, verses 3 through 5. It's the plan of redemption and rest. Verses 1 through 5, the plan of redemption and rest. Scene 2 is verses 6 through 15, and it's the operation of redemption and rest. Verses 6 through 15, the operation of redemption and rest. And scene 3 is verses 16 through 18, the wait for redemption and rest. The wait for redemption and rest, verses 16 through 18. If you missed that, come up to me afterwards and I'll share it with you. Verses 1 through 5, verses 6 through 15, and verses 6 through 18 are the framework for the chapter. So normally this is where I'd say, now that we have kind of an understanding of how the chapter works, let's read it. But we already read the passage, so we're going to jump right into verse number 1. Look at verses 1 and 2. Then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, "My daughter, should I not seek rest for you that it may be well with you? Is not Boaz our relative with whose young women you were? See, he is winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor." Now, several weeks have elapsed since the end of chapter 2. in the process of harvesting, they have now moved to from the harvest fields to the threshing floor. Normally a couple weeks process. But I want you to notice Naomi's words to Ruth here. Should I not seek, and I highlighted it in reading it, should I not seek rest for you, that you may be well? The word rest describes a settled spot, a resting place, a place of quietness and security free from chaos and harm. It intentionally draws our attention back to Naomi's words to Ruth and Orpah in 1 verse 9, where she expresses a desire for Yahweh to provide each of them with a place of rest, security, and safety in the house of her husband. Look at verse 9. This is Naomi talking. She's actually telling Orpah and Ruth to go back to Moab, where they can establish a home for themselves. But she says, and she uses the covenant name Yahweh here, the Lord grant that you may find, here's that word, rest, each of you in the house of her husband. I want you to keep that idea of rest in your mind, because it will play a role in this chapter. I'll come back to it at the end. You'll find the idea of rest right in the last verse. Once again, verse 18, if you want to peek ahead, go ahead. But just kind of put that in the back of your mind, and we're going to keep moving. Tuck it away in your mind until we get to the end of the chapter. So again, the scene has changed. We've moved from the harvest field to the threshing floor, where grain is separated from the shell and husks to kind of get the meat of each seed and each grain. It's like, I like sunflower seeds. If you eat sunflower seeds properly, then you break the seed in your mouth and you get the shell out and you actually eat the meat of the seed. This is kind of the same idea what's going on here, but in the grain, as they harvest barley, they're kind of smashing the grain, not so hard that it breaks the meat so much, but that it breaks the husk or the shell out. And then they would throw it in the air, and oftentimes the wind would blow the husk away. That's what's going on here. They're getting the grain, the good part of the grain, and cutting the bad part of the grain out, letting it blow away, a chaff blown away. The grains, keep in mind that at this time of year, or at this time of the world, grain was extremely important for life. I mean, grain equaled life. Grain's necessity for life is not much different today, right? So if you don't have grain, you don't survive. You can't feed your chickens sometimes, you can't feed your animals, and you can't eat bread. So it's very similar today. But if you think back into the time here, we didn't have, back in the day, we didn't have tractors. They didn't have tractors to harvest and then big grain silos. And actually, if you read through the historical books, you'll find that the Philistines oftentimes attacked the threshing floor because that was attacking essentially the life of that community. Get the grain, beat the community, bring them into submission. That's the same idea that you see in Exodus with Joseph and the Pharaoh. They had so much grain that essentially no one else in the world had grain, so they were coming to Egypt for life. That's the same idea. So this is also why Naomi knows exactly where Boaz will spend the night, because Boaz and all of his men will likely be armed to the hilt, sleeping with the grain to protect it from marauders and animals that may come by to eat their grain. So with that in mind, look at verse 3. Wash, therefore, still Naomi talking, wash, therefore, and anoint yourself, and put on your cloak, and go down to the threshing floor, but do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. Here is where Naomi begins to devise her plan of redemption, and that plan begins with a bath. Ruth, you stink. You've been working in the field. You got dirt all over you. You need a bath. So it's obvious, this first part, the reason why Naomi wants Ruth to wash herself and put on perfume. She's been working hard at the farm for several weeks now, and I can imagine the smell. Growing up, I used to mow lawns. How I paid for college is our family had a lawn business. And I remember distinctly the smell that came home with me at the end of the day. In fact, one time I remember we were mowing lawns and went into a gas station, and the gas station attendant looked at us. We had been doing work on a mower, like a motor, because something had broken. So we not only smelled bad, but looked completely dirty. She looked at us and said, "Have you guys ever heard of a shower?" We stunk and we looked bad. And that's kind of the idea of what's going on here, is that Ruth, you stink. Wash yourself and put on get rid of that man repellent and put on man attractant. So she also needed to put on her best garments. Now there's different ideas as to why this happened, but some take this to mean wedding clothes, that she needs to put on wedding garments, and that's the idea being happening here. I don't think the text is that specific. It's more likely that since Mahlon's death, her husband, Ruth has been wearing certain clothes. She's been wearing mourning clothes. And so by changing her garments, she was indicating to all eligible bachelors, "I am on the market." She's indicating that her mourning period was over and that she was now eligible for remarriage. Now, notice that she has on her cloak, which is basically a shawl that would keep her warm at night, and also in the scenery may also function as, in some measure, to protect her face from being recognized, kind of shrouding her face in the environment. Now, Naomi lays out the timeline here. Go to the threshing floor at twilight. Don't make yourself known to Boaz. And after Boaz has finished eating and drinking and is happily eating and drinking, he'll be ready for a good night of sleep. I mean, think about it. After a good, hard day's work, and you enjoy a good beverage and a good meal, there's nothing better than a good night's sleep. And that's what Naomi has in her mind. The way to a man's heart is through his stomach, right? And that's kind of what's going on here. Wait until he's sound asleep to approach him. Once he's asleep, sneak up to him and uncover his feet and lay down to sleep at his feet. Now, that sounds weird to me, but it's part of the plan. When he wakes up, he'll tell you what to do. Now, I want to think about this. Why is there secrecy here? Why didn't she just walk up to him in the broad daylight and say, "Hey, Boaz, I'm available. Can you marry me?" Why the secrecy? It's likely that Ruth's beauty and quality of character are now known to the entire area, and all the young men and all the older men, are now, if she was wearing new garments, would see her as an eligible person to pursue. Well, so this is my opinion on it, and I could be wrong, but afterwards we can argue about it and you'll see that I'm right. Ruth is likely secretly revealing to Boaz that her mourning period is over and that she wants him to be her husband. She wants him to know first. She's likely not wanting her eligibility to be known publicly until Boaz knows first. So, but there's even more on the line for Ruth here. If you think back to the Moabites and their origins, begin with strong drink and a night's sleep. Lot, intoxicated by his daughters, and then he sleeps with them and an incestuous relation takes place. Lot drinks himself into a drunken stupor to fall asleep and be coaxed into an incestuous relationship with his daughters. That's the stereotype of a Moabite woman. Completely opposite of how Ruth's character and person and morals hold up in the life of this book. If they are caught, Ruth would fit right into the stereotypical mold of a Moabite woman, which may confine her and Naomi into a life of poverty. But if this went well, Ruth and Naomi would be led to that place of rest that Naomi mentions in the first chapter and again here in chapter 3. It's a high-stakes poker game, and these two ladies are literally betting the farm on the results. Ruth replies, "All that you say, I will do." The curtain from scene one closes, and we find ourselves at the threshing floor in the next verse, in verses 6 through 7. Ruth, well, the scene closes, and with a sense of risk, as we envision Ruth walking by faith to the threshing floor in her new clothes to meet Boaz in a risky midnight rendezvous. Scene 2 opens with Ruth's arrival at the threshing floor. Look at verses 6 and 7. "So she went down to the threshing floor and did just as her mother-in-law had commanded her. And when Boaz had eaten and drunk, and his heart was merry, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain. Then she came softly and uncovered his feet and laid down." Now, the typical environment of a threshing floor was not just a quiet, calm, peaceful place. It was not a place for the innocent. It was a place that often was known for its promiscuity. Prostitutes would often arrive to present their services to the men at the end of the day after they had indulged in plenty of food and lots of harvest drink. So Naomi's plans not only put Ruth in an extremely vulnerable position, it's not just that. She doesn't have a husband or a father to defend her. Ruth literally has to cast herself on trusting in Yahweh here. So shrouded in her shawl, Ruth passively observes the festivities on the outskirts of the crowd and carefully watches Boaz from a distance. He enjoys the good fruit of the harvest God has given. With a full belly and a happy heart, he lays to rest at one of the ends of the pile of grain, which is where he would rightfully, where he should be sitting. You should expect the owner of the land to be laying down at the end of the pile of grain. The first, if someone is going to attack, he's the first to defend it. So Ruth watches from a distance and waits until Boaz is sound asleep. Maybe she listens for a consistent snore coming from Boaz's bed. Look at the end of verse 7. "Then she came softly." The idea is that she stealthily slipped, tiptoed in unnoticed into a position to uncover his feet. Now, without getting too graphic, there's some sexual tension in the whole scene. And the Hebrew word for uncover his feet leaves little to Boaz's imagination. By uncovering his feet, Ruth is clearly declaring her desire to marry Boaz. So she uncovers his feet, lays down, and waits to see what happens. Can you feel the tension? Ruth and Naomi's future hangs in the balance, and everything is at stake as Ruth lays quietly next to this armed man, snoring the night away. She waits. The hours slowly tick by. And then at midnight, he awakes, startled. Look at verse 8. At midnight, the man was startled and turned over, and behold, a woman lay at his feet. There's an anxiety in this word startled. It's like, whoa. We aren't told what startles him, so perhaps he had a bad dream with Moabites trying to steal his grain. Perhaps his feet were cold. They were exposed. Perhaps he bumped into Ruth, who was sleeping there. Either way, the idea is that he's sleeping and he turns over startled. There's someone in my life who wakes up frequently startled. What's going on? It's obviously me, of course, you know. But the idea is that he turned over and is startled. What? Oh, what's going on here? Either way, he wakes up startled, whirls around, and finds a woman laying at his feet. Look at what he says in verse 9. He says, "Who are you?" And she answered, "I am Ruth, your servant." I'll pause there. Boaz rubs his tired eyes. If he had glasses, he would have put them on to see more clearly what was going on, perhaps trying to decipher between what is dream and reality. What? There's a woman at my feet. There's a clumsiness in the Hebrew syntax of Boaz's words here, indicating the nature of a single man who has just been startlingly roused only to find a beautiful woman laying at his feet. There's a bumbling and a terseness as if his brain and his eyes have not yet caught up with his mouth. So that's the scene. You ever been startled or woken up in the middle of the night? You wake up. Do you wake up with a saintly, chipper disposition? I see chuckling going on. Yeah, I know I do not. My children know who to go to at night in the event of something startling. So look how Ruth answers, though. "I am Ruth, your servant. Spread your wings over your servant," mentioned twice here, "for you are a redeemer." She reveals her identity, but shifts the focus back to him because his identity is really what matters, not hers. She is insignificant in this whole thing. He's important. So spread your wings over your servant because you, Boaz, are the Redeemer. Now, do Ruth's words here ring any bells in the memory of Ruth? The story. Look back at Boaz's words in chapter 2, verse 12. "The Lord repay you for what you have done, and a full reward be given you by the Lord, the God of Israel." Here we go. "Under whose wings you have come to take refuge." The word for wing can be used to describe just obviously the wings of a bird. I mean, to take like little children, we talked about this last week, like little chicks or little birdies coming to take refuge and get warmth under their mommy hen's wings. But it could also be used to describe the edges of a garment. And that's what Ruth is doing here. Ruth is politely demanding, notice it's not a question, politely demanding that Boaz take up the mantle of his responsibility as a kinsman redeemer and become the practical demonstration of Yahweh's wings by spreading the edges of his garment over her. She wants him to draw her in close, to protect her and keep her warm. She wants that place of rest. Marriage. Naomi mentioned this in chapter 1 and again in chapter 3. Now think about the situation here. It's kind of flipped. It's culturally backwards. A poor Moabite servant who's a widow is telling her wealthy Israelite boss what to do, and not just telling him what to do, but telling him to marry her. It's awkward. Now, Ruth delivers her message, and we sit on a razor's edge as we wait for Boaz's response. How is Boaz going to respond? Boaz's response could end all hopes of Ruth and Naomi finding rest by rejecting Ruth and treating her poorly. If he's a cowardly man of base character, he could take immoral advantage of her vulnerable, defenseless position, use her, and then discard her to grovel for grain the rest of her life. He's in the place of power and authority. She's in the place of need and vulnerability. She has no husband or father to defend her, and his true character is about to be revealed. Then Boaz opens his mouth. And once again, blessings come out. Look at verse 10. And he said, "May you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter. You have made this last kindness greater than the first, in that you have not gone after young men, whether rich or poor." He prays a blessing of Yahweh over her and once again refers to this hesed, steadfast love that she's demonstrating with her actions. You see, in her marriage to Mahlon, she had entered a covenant that was grounded on Mahlon's God, Yahweh, and Yahweh's law. She was staying loyal to the covenant with her dead husband and his God because that was what Yahweh commanded. So when she had come back with Naomi, she was staying loyal to her covenant with Mahlon. Orpah abandoned that covenant. She had demonstrated that covenant with Naomi, and now she had stayed loyal to her covenant with Mahlon, her husband, Naomi, Elimelech, and now Boaz, because she firmly trusted in Yahweh to not only provide grain seed, but seed for children. And Boaz is referring to Ruth's hesed love, her covenant loyalty, because she had not only gone back, she refused to go back with Orpah to Moab, clinging to Naomi, but she had gone after, not gone after younger, more eligible men. She was following Yahweh's law by faith, and in so doing, she was demonstrating steadfast love for God and for people. That's how the law of God works. When we love the Lord, it spills out in love for our neighbor. Now, I want to pause here to notice Boaz's upstanding, exemplary character. This man is of substantial character and is an example that all of us men should follow and should seek in our lives. At nearly every turn, Boaz reminds us of God's character. Here, once again, by spreading his wings, he's referencing his own words that she sought refuge under Yahweh's wings. In this specific instance, Boaz is in a very tempting situation where he could take sexual advantage over Ruth. But like Joseph, Boaz does the right thing out of fear of God. He was in the seat of power. He could have taken from Ruth, but he doesn't. He shows her kindness and protects her dignity. Men, this is our God-given role on this earth. Protect the innocent, the vulnerable. Provide for those under our care. Show generosity to those God brings across our path. Show dignity to all. While our culture may term Boaz's character as toxic masculinity, Boaz reminds us what God wants in a man. His first priority is to live according to God's word, as displayed in his commitment to follow the law in the process of marrying Ruth. He's a man of integrity. He demonstrates self-control to moral character and even to intoxicating drinks here. He is hardworking and cares about the well-being of those working under him. At work, he doesn't just care about getting the job done, but he cares about the people he's working with and those who work underneath him. He is a wise and well-respected businessman. Every time he speaks, joy and blessing come out of his mouth. Boaz's character points us to Jesus. From his very first words, Emmanuel, God with us. Like Jesus, Boaz is lavish in dispensing grace to the lowly and generous in his care of the poor. He protects and cares for the needy, the weak, the sick, the widows, even women caught in adultery. He gives his own life and resources to redeem the sinner. Men, Boaz's character points us to Jesus' character. To whom does your character point people? Let's keep going. While Boaz's words of blessing ease the tension of the night, they add yet another layer of complication and really kind of just stress to the story. There's a closer redeemer who has first claim to redeem Elimelech's land and lineage. Boaz then commits to do everything within his power to marry Ruth the way Yahweh has laid out in his law. Then he tells her to lay at his feet until morning. I can't imagine that either of them got any sleep the rest of the night. You think about Boaz staring up at the stars, thinking about what that conversation is going to look like tomorrow. How am I going to do this? As he plots his strategy to marry Ruth. So as morning approaches and birds begin to chirp, Boaz discreetly sends her home before dawn breaks, when criminals do not typically attack and when her identity can stay hidden. He's protecting her even when he sends her home. Look at what he says in verse number 15. And he said, "Bring out the garment you're wearing and hold it." Here's that garment again. The act of kindness is not simply him giving her grain. There's more to it. So, just keep reading. So she held it out, and he measured out 6 measures of barley and put it on her. Then she went into the city. And we have a scene change here. And when she comes, she then again, in verse 17, tells Naomi what happens. And the first thing she measures, she talks about in verse number 17 is this. "These 6 measures of barley he gave to me." Right away, you find the same, you talk about the specific reference to 6 measures of garlic, of barley. Not garlic. Man, bad breath. It's bad for kissing. Yeah. So he mentions that. She mentions that specifically. So what's happening here? 6 measures. And we don't know exactly what those measures are. It's most likely not an ephah like the first measurement we saw in chapter 2. Because 6 ephahs would be like hundreds of pounds. Hey, Ruth, let me like bless you with 6 measures and load you up so that you have to like crawl your way home. She couldn't have done that. So it's more likely something, a polite measurement that is substantial enough for her to know this carries weight, but not so substantial that would crush her. So what's happening here? In a way, Boaz is giving a bit of a down payment and an assurance of his intentions to take up the responsibility of being their redeemer and to marry Ruth. Now, the specific measurement of 6 puzzled my mind as I worked through this. It carries significance. It's significant, especially when talking about marriage. Now, one rabbi explains the significance of the number 6 in the Hebrew Scriptures when he writes, and I quote, 6 is a special number. The 6 days of creation culminate in Sabbath, the day of rest. Remember the theme that we're going through? However, the number 6 is a multiple, reminding us of God's words to be fruitful and multiply. And it's a multiple of 2 and 3, the symbols, the numbers for male and female. The marriage of a male and female is a joining. Indeed, the animals and then finally mankind were created on the 6th day of creation, which makes it a special number for mankind. So when he's talking about 6 measures here, and it's mentioned twice in the passage, there's significance. So by giving Ruth 6 measures of barley, he's drawing themes from the creation account and sending her home, not empty-handed, once again referencing Naomi's words in chapter 1. But essentially, Boaz is saying that I will not only fill this garment you have, this shawl, with barley seeds, but with human seed, a baby from our marriage. But there are only 6 measures, not 7, the number of completion and rest. There's still work to do. Then he sends her home, concluding Act 2 and beginning Act 3, where once again we conclude with a conversation between these two sweet ladies. I want to focus on Naomi's words in verse 18. Look at verse 18. She replied, "Wait, my daughter, until you learn how the matter turns out, for the man will not..." What's the word? Rest. "The man will not rest, but will settle the matter today." Isn't it interesting that in 1 verse 9 and 3 verse 1, Naomi says that the place of rest, security, and provision is found in the house of her husband. As we see consistently in this narrative, God's hand is orchestrating all the events in the story to create a place of rest for Ruth and Naomi. And the idea of rest bookends this chapter, right at the beginning and right at the end. We can't rest yet, though, alluding to the fact that full rest is coming. A rest is central to the story of Ruth, and the mention of 6 measures of barley is a literary device that is intended, again, to draw our attention back to the creation account and the Garden of Eden. It's here that God created the first place of rest, with the first marriage union between one man and one woman who lived together in harmony, peace, safety, security, and pleasure. The union between Adam and Eve was a place of rest and security because it was based on their relationship with God. And the unfractured relationship with God served as the foundation and fuel for that place of rest and their marriage union. But something happened. Adam and Eve's sin corrupted the marriage union because it fractured the foundational relationship, their relationship with God. God designed marriage to flourish as a result of his presence, which provides rest, peace, and security. The whole storyline of Ruth reminds us Naomi's state of emptiness in chapter 1 came as a result of her leaving Yahweh's land, where God dwelt with his people. The promised land was intended to be to point people's minds not just back to the Garden of Eden, but to the eternal rest that we have with Yahweh. The storyline reminds us of that. Their departure from Yahweh resulted in emptiness and brokenness in their marriages and in their lives. And this is a major theme in Ruth and in the Bible. Rest is found by taking refuge under Yahweh's wings. It's the same today. God's presence is the source of a healthy marriage as a place of rest. God designed marriage to have Him at its center, making it a place of rest and security. So let me ask you, how would you describe your marriage? Is it a place of rest and security that reminds you of not just the Garden of Eden, but the better Eden to come? Or is it crumbling, fractured? You see, in our fallen world, the gospel reunites us with our Creator and reestablishes our marriage as a place of rest, security, and safety with Christ at the center. Will each marriage have bumps and problems? Yes, mine does, because I'm a sinner. Our marriages are made and comprised of sinful people who are constantly learning to forgive one another and to keep Christ as the center of our marriage. But a marriage that reminds us of Eden is one redeemed by Christ through the gospel. So, how would you describe your marriage? If your marriage is described more by chaos, tension, disunity, anger, frustration, and shouting. Your marriage doesn't just have an anger problem, it has a God problem. Ruth reminds us how to get back to the place of rest, peace, and security. Return to Yahweh and trust in Him. In simple terms, the basic way to restore a broken marriage is to turn in faith to Christ, just like Ruth. She turns from her former idols, her land, and her family, and she trusts in Yahweh. Rest in your marriage begins with each of us turning from the idols of our hearts, asking forgiveness, forgiving one another, and trusting in Jesus' work on the cross to produce sanctification through His Spirit. Healthy marriages, places of rest and security, are built on union with Christ through the gospel. The idea of rest in marriage bookends the chapter, as I've already pointed out. It also bookends the whole Bible. You begin with the Garden of Eden and you find rest at the end of the Bible in the book of Revelation. So the Bible begins with a place of rest, the first marriage union in the Garden of Eden, and the Bible concludes with a place of rest found in yet another marital union between the Lamb and His bride, the church. So in a sense, this chapter is a microcosm of the whole story of the Bible, with a plan of redemption in the middle, and the bride awaiting the return of her groom at the end, echoing Naomi's words, "Wait, my daughter, until you learn how the matter turns out, for the man will not rest, but will settle the matter today." Unlike the hint of doubt in Naomi's words, we don't await a potential return of our Redeemer. It's sure, it's steadfast. The Holy Spirit has been given to us as a down payment for the great wedding to come, a dowry. We live in the already not yet in this world, in the redemption plan, right where we end chapter 3, waiting our King, our groom, to return and sweep us up to take us home with Him forever. We live in the already not yet of the redemption plan right this very minute. And like Naomi's words state in verse 18, we await the sweet reunion of our groom as he prepares a place for us. You hear those words anywhere in the Gospels? John 14. Jesus says, "Do not let your heart be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me. I'm going to prepare a place for you. And when I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and sweep you off your feet to dwell with me forever." That's the Aaron Scott translation. We wait for a sweet reunion with our groom someday. Someday he will return and we will be with him forever in a place of rest. I want to conclude by reading two verses from one of my favorite hymns. You ask what's my favorite hymn, it depends on the week. The church's one foundation is Jesus Christ, her Lord. She is his new creation by water and the word. From heaven he came and sought her to be his holy bride. With his own blood he bought her, and for her life he died. One of the last verses. Mid toil and tribulation and tumult of her war, she waits the consummation of peace forevermore. Till with a vision glorious her longing eyes are blessed, and the great church victorious shall be the church at rest. We look for that day, that time where we will rest with our great groom forever. Let's pray.